brought to you by the Bose A20 Aviation Headset. Better sound is important, which is why, with 30% greater noise reduction than conventional aviation headsets, the A20 lets you hear more of what you need to hear, so you can focus on what matters, flying. And by XMWX Satellite Weather. Onboard nationwide radar, lightning, winds, and so much more. XMWX Satellite Weather gives you the full perspective on the weather on any compatible device you choose. Come see the latest at AOPA Summit, booth 922, or visit xmwxweather.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Paul Bertarelli reporting from AOPA Summit in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm with Jack Pelton, the president of EAA and former president of CESA. Jack, you flew your 414 down here, but you're kind of a rarity. I've been talking to people here who've arrived mostly via airline or driving, and many of them are saying they can't afford the cost of fuel, can't justify it. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is EAA's position towards MoGas. In the 80s, it was very supportive of MoGas, kind of got out of it. Now we've got Airworthy Autogas coming out, which is, for all intents and purposes, a certified MoGas. What's your view, and what do you think EAA should be doing to support that initiative?
Well, Paul, as you know, back in the 80s, EAA spent a lot of time and effort and money on getting STCs for the MoGas. So, you know, we were clearly supportive of it then. We are supportive of it now. I think if people watched where they may have viewed us to not show as much support was the issue with all the ethanol content, where then it just kind of blew up our STC. If we can get airworthy MoGas and if we can get distribution of it onto the airports, we are all in favor of that because it's a perfect solution for most of our home-built airplanes. They're low compression, helps bring the price point down on fuel, gets people flying again. It's a really relatively recent development with the airworthy MoGas, so as that starts to get some better understanding and understand how we can help facilitate it, we will be raising our hand and we'll be front and center to try to make that happen.
What specifically can or would the association do?
Well, we'll certainly work through the regulatory side to whatever continued expansion of the existing STC needs to happen. We'll work with the local airport communities and what does it take to store and provide that airplane. We'll use our advocacy efforts and our grassroots membership and chapters that are out there to facilitate any way we can. I mean, we have got to find these kinds of solutions to get people flying again. I'm more adamant about that than ever because myself, you know, I budget my flying, and my flying budget is now getting consumed with aviation fuel prices, which causes me to fly less. My friends that I associate with, that we get in our airplanes and we go places, especially our antique airplanes, you know, we're finding ourselves for the first time ever at the beginning of the year saying, okay, gang, what events are this year that we want to go to? You know, what? And I'm talking grassroots flyings. I'm not talking Oshkosh. I'm talking about the local Kansas events and saying, which ones are we going to go to? And it's not like it's in the years past where we just went to, you know, on a Wednesday, we'd say, hey, there's a EAA flying Ponca City, Oklahoma, having pancakes. See you there. It's no longer the case anymore. We're actually sitting down and actually planning through the year. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? Because of the fuel costs.
We've talked to a number of FBOs who, well, they may like the idea. The barrier for them is the capital cost of installing the additional tankage. How do you get over that barrier?
Well, you hear that a lot, and I know some of that's been the frustration with the stronger and stronger Environmental Protection Agency rules on storage. But, you know, I think there's a lot of that we just got to get creative and figure solutions around that. If a local airport's fuel consumption as far as gallonage is and I hate to throw a number out there because I'm not informed well enough to do that. But if you can almost like they have in the countryside of Kansas where you have co-ops where you could get a truck to go to a common place to be able to fill up a large aviation fuel truck and keep that resident on your airport, I mean, that should be able to keep you running and keep airplanes going. So there's ways to crack this nut. I mean, it doesn't have to be put in a 40,000-gallon tank in the ground of your facility. I mean, we've got, you know, many, many airports within 30 nautical mile circle and radius, and how do you facilitate that?
Segue a little bit into diesel. We talked to you at Oshkosh about that with the Redbird Red Hawk project. If you kind of cast the net a little wider and take a view of the horizon, what are you seeing as the penetration of diesel aircraft, say, on a percentage wise to the entire market? And what impact is that going to have on the cost of flying on an hourly cost basis?
Well, I'll answer the second question first, because on the cost of flying on an hourly basis, the change is probably in the neighborhood of 13%, 14%. It's significant, and it's not necessarily in the cost of fuel as much as it is how much more you get out of that fuel. The range specifics on it are so much better than current avgas. That's where the payback comes. The ironic thing is today, jet fuel is so much cheaper than, and I say so much, a dollar a gallon is a lot. If you're filling up a 80-gallon tank of a 182, I mean, that's $80 a fill-up savings, which is, real money. So, today we're seeing Jet A priced so much below 100 low lead, and I think that gap, that spread will remain. I don't see 100 low lead plummeting in price. So that cost benefit will always be there. It's ironic that on diesel fuel for cars, it's higher than automotive. But then when you look at percentage of where is diesel going to go, if the manufacturers and this aftermarket remanufacturing can get spooled up, I think you're going to see the flight schools adapt at first. I think if the price point is right, you'll see individuals. But there's a large installed base of older airplanes that burn 100 low lead that economically aren't just going to go out and scrap their engine to put a diesel in. So it's going to take some time before you see the actual percentage make a meaningful difference.
If you're guessing, what is that timeline?
I would say it's probably 2020. And I'm the reason I'm saying that is I'm looking at that's kind of the timeline that we've got some decisions to make around 100 low lead. People have slowed down their nervous concern, do I buy an airplane because of 100 low lead going away? But at the same time, there's nobody offering any real diesel solutions. I mean, we've got the Centurion engine now on the Redbird. Cessna's has yet to certify the 182 with the diesel, but that's coming. And then the Diamond folks have their Austral engine out there. But that we're going to have to see some more confidence building in having an engine out there that people feel confident in and a price point that makes sense.
Last question, I'll segue into where we are with getting the FAA to pay for air traffic services at AirVenture. Any progress there?
We're not making any progress in that. We do have an active lawsuit that we are feeling, very confident that we have a very, very strong position that the FAA is not legally allowed to have charges for those services, and that's playing out in the Ninth Circuit, and we'll probably not have an answer on that until spring. We're really positioning ourselves to say we're going to have to pay again next year, and we're going to have to find a way to get the FAA to be reasonable in what that cost is. And then, we've got a lawsuit in play. We have sequestration. No budget, at best maybe a continuing resolution. You could not ask for more chaos in the budgeting process of the FAA, which unfortunately we're all going to be victims of it, whether it be through our control tower or people getting registrations on airplanes done today, or a young man I was talking to the other day that was getting ready to renew his medical he wasn't getting ready to do his medical, because I understand that is online. He's getting ready to take a check ride. And he couldn't go out and access the system to put in his information to go take the check ride with the DPE. It's just broke everywhere around us in aviation. It's troubling times.
What do you think the likelihood or possibility is of privatizing that tower, not having a tower when you don't need it during AirVenture, and then using a private contractor to run AirVenture?
It's an avenue we're pursuing. We looked at it. Unfortunately, we only had about 60 days prior to AirVenture, but we talked to the currently that tower is operated by a privatized facility today. They didn't have enough time to really ramp up and relocate people, but that would certainly be an option. There's volunteer military controllers, there's retired FAA controllers. We'd have to figure out how to keep the equipment up and running in a reasonable state to do it for AirVenture. But there's no reason we can't continue to find a way to have a tower operating at AirVenture 1 week a year to make sure the event goes on.
So you wouldn't rule out doing it that way?
Absolutely not. And the FAA administrator was very open in saying, hey, if you guys got a better solution or a way to get this done, have at it. And we are continuing to explore that.
All right, Jack. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Paul.
This is Paul Bertarelli reporting from AOPA Summit at Fort Worth. We've been talking to Jack Pelton, president of EAA. Thanks for listening.